CliffCentral.com.
It is Thursday morning, ahead of a long weekend. A lot of people already very relaxed. This has been a quiet week for many people. I don't know so many who've actually been at work at all in the last couple of days. But if you have, pat yourself on the back. You are keeping the economy going, which is a far, far nobler thing than having a nice, fat, long holiday. All right, we're going to be talking in the next little bit to a guy who really has had the most extraordinary life. I mean, when you talk about journalists, you get those ones who are world famous, who've done huge international events. The size and scope of their CVs is almost unbelievable. You know, you've got people like Christian Amanpour, and one of those people is the guest that we have here this morning, Milton Nkosi, who has been BBC's Africa Bureau analyst and correspondent. He's been with the BBC for more than 20 years. He was in Iraq during that whole mess. He was part of, he covered the fall of Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire, which became the Congo. He's covered in South Africa the fall of the apartheid regime, the rise of the ANC under Nelson Mandela, and obviously the transition of South Africa into a peaceful democracy. Such an incredible life. I'm so pleased to have him here. I can't begin to tell you how cool it is to have someone. I was talking to Alistair Sparks the other day, who's also, you know, one of those journalists who's been around a long time, Milton. And hearing from people like him and hearing from people like you reminds us all of the long perspective of history, which we sometimes lose in a world of Twitter and instant news. And we get bored so quickly these days. If you don't look at things through the long lens, you don't have an appreciation, right?
Yes, indeed. And good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
It's good to be here. It is very, very important in the new information age, where digital is so much engrossed in our lives, mm-hmm. that we should quite often take stock and step back, have a slightly larger perspective on issues. Because, you know, nowadays, when you follow the social media and 24-hour news channels, story breaks at 11 in the morning. By 5 p.m., it's history. It's not mentioned anywhere by the 7 p.m. news.
Right.
So it's so important to step back and look at the events, how they form, how they shape. And that's why historians are more important now in the 21st century than ever before.
Well, that makes me very happy because I'm a fan of history. And I love the work that people like you do to contribute to that history. You're documenting history every step of the way.
Yeah, the advantage, and to be honest, it's a privilege and an honor to be afforded the chance to sit in the front row and witness history unfold, which is something that doesn't pay that much.
No, unfortunately,
but
it
my
should.
Goodness, it
there should be danger
you,
pay, right?
Very true. But it gives you such a good feeling where you get to understand why people do things, why people go to wars, and why people forgive in the most extraordinary ways. You just walk away completely bewildered by just humanity.
Now, you were born in Soweto. Was there ever a time when you were a little kid that you could envisage or you could imagine the sort of life that you've had?
I wish I could say that because I love being a visionary, but unfortunately not. I just grew up like any other kid. I used to dream of being an Orlando Pirates football player.
Sure.
And then I dreamt of being a famous movie star in the local dramas. When I grew up, there were wonderful dramas that we used to watch. And your mind just goes wild. You think you'll be a musician. I used to follow Motown music a lot when I grew up. And you'd think I'd be as famous as the OJs or the Commodores.
Oh, wow.
Nothing could ever have prepared me for what I do now.
And you didn't even study anything to do with journalism.
Yeah, I did journalist training.
But not in the beginning.
In the beginning, no, not at all. When I finished matric, I studied teaching in civil engineering, completed that, and then started freelancing for international television crews after doing a few other various jobs, mm-hmm. just trying to survive. And in the end, I went to train in what is now known as the BBC College of Journalism in London, and worked my way up in the BBC from a fixer, translator to producer, Africa producer, and then I became head of Africa for 7 years. And then after that, I went to Asia to run South Asia for BBC News for 4 years, spent a lot of time traveling across India, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Nepal, and in between did some of the big wars, you know, in the Middle East, like you mentioned earlier when you were introducing me. So over time, and then I did a management and leadership program at Ashridge College in Hertfordshire.
So you're supremely qualified then, but I mean, experience is everything in your game.
Very much so. Nothing can ever teach you better than experience. And that's why every day when we talk about unemployment, we're talking about internships. Internships, in simple language for ordinary folk like us, is just experience. Give me a chance to experience how to do the job, and then I can prove myself. It doesn't matter whether you got a straight A at university or you right. came with a D, if you turn up on the factory floor and you prove yourself, that's the opportunity that everybody wants.
Now, I want to jump straight into all of these things that you've covered in your career as a journalist, but it's almost too tempting because there's so many. I'm kind of interested that through all of this, you've also got a wife and 2 kids.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how that happened.
How did you manage that in between, you know, Basra and Mobutu Sese Seko and South Asia? I mean, how does this happen?
Well, in fairness, credit goes to my wife, Dorcas, who took a risk with a guy who was never home and just
that poor woman.
Poor her. So we're always grateful to her. And we're blessed with 2 beautiful kids. My son, Khosizile, is 15 years old. And my daughter, Kanyisile, is 14 years old. So we're grateful for that.
They must be proud of their dad. Do they have an appreciation for the kinds of things you've lived through?
Well, most times I'm not even sure that they know how proud they should be.
Yes, exactly. They look at you and go, "Dad, where's our pocket money?"
Yeah, exactly. You know, but what happens is that sometimes you get snippets out of the blue that. Leaves you with a lump in your throat.
I think it must be a real pleasure for them to come home and say, "Dad, I've got this history assignment. Can you help?"
Well,
because that's the one place you could be the best.
Well, in fairness, they don't like the idea that I want to listen to every bulletin, every top of the hour, all channels, all radio stations, and still read the tweets and watch Instagram and read the WhatsApp groups and so on. So they get really bored each time I say, "Guys, please let's just listen just to the top of the news." To be honest, I want to listen to the whole thing, but I have to squeeze in there, you know,
you
the teenagers.
Do you think it's something you're just born with, this desire to know what's going on? Because they're news hounds. You're obviously one of them. These people who just can't get enough information and news. You're constantly curious about the world around you.
Yeah, I learned that when I was in high school, that knowledge is power. And nowadays, it doesn't matter that much that you actually know, because we all know. We all have access to Google in our pockets, on our mobile phones. So the question now is, what do you do with the information, and when did you know? That's key.
Yeah.
Timing is everything.
And in your life, there's never a dull day, because there's always breaking news somewhere.
Yeah, sometimes there is news that you would rather not break. because, no, you know, especially the dim and the dark stories that we tell of the lowest points of humanity, when human beings absolutely shock you with the level that they can stoop down to in order to make a point. So, for example, I spent a lot of time in Sierra Leone in the war, and there used to be a guy called Fode Sanko, who ran a rebel group called the Revolutionary United Front, RUF, and what they used to do is that they used to chop people's hands off, not the arm, you know, not the whole arm, just the from the wrist, because they wanted those people not to vote for the government. And when you walk around in villages and you look at old, dignified beautiful people, young people with a future ahead of themselves, and they have no risk. They can't write, they can't do anything.
God.
Then you realize that, my goodness, we can stoop very, very low as human beings, you know. But of course, then there is the opposite end when you see Nelson Mandela coming out of prison and he calls himself the servant of the people, you know, when we think he is the boss.
Yeah,
it sounds like sometimes you could do with a therapy session or two after having covered a harrowing story. I mean, how do you not take that stuff back home with you and into your personal life?
Mm. Oh yeah, that's very true. Very good question, because we are all human. You know, in journalism, you guys know it better than most, that we're expected to be neutral, to be balanced, to be impartial, and stay right in the middle.
No, we don't. Mabale does that. I don't.
Well, we are expected to do that, particularly where I work in the BBC. Mm. Those are key values. But, you know, after all, we're humans. We're not machines. And we feel, we laugh, we cry. And there are stories that blow your mind. For example, I covered the Bui Patong massacre. Mm. And I went to Bui Patong, a township I'd never heard of, just south of Sebokeng. And I interviewed a young guy who was 15 at the time. And he was describing to me how he survived the attack. So hostel dwellers came into the township with spears, guns, and they were just shooting at random, killing, going into people's houses. And he told me that he hid under the bed. And while he was under the bed, he could see his aunts, his grandmother being killed. But watching the feet of the guys, he saw one guy just stab a table. He was just stabbing a table with a spear. And he could not believe the sheer power of hatred at that point, from someone he didn't know to someone they didn't know. And I interviewed that guy. I left. It was a very straightforward interview, good material in our language. Went back to the office, sent the thing to London. And someone said to me, "How was Bui Patong?" I completely collapsed. I burst into tears like a child, and I sobbed and cried like I'd never cried before. And that came from left side. I did not expect that. I never saw it coming. I didn't think I was affected by what the guy told me. It was just that question, how was Bui Patong? Mm. And that's what broke me. So, Mabale, you are right. We sometimes carry a lot of baggage with us. And to be honest, I think that people who do some of this stuff are, in part, speaking for myself here, a little bit mad.
Well, I mean, you don't strike me as being a dangerously insane person, although I think going to places like Darfur and Iraq, you have to have a little bit of adventure in you. You have to be a little bit crazy.
Yeah, sure. But also, like you, you have to carry the balancing act of human strategies to go through life. For example, I try very hard to maintain my sense of humor, even when I'm actually staring at some of the most dangerous experiences I've had in my life. So you laugh a lot. You see a lot of people in trouble laughing. Mm. So it just it keeps you sane. It keeps you balanced. So I come from a home where humor was used in various guises. Even, you know, there's a very nice saying in Zulu about consoling people during a time of mourning when someone has died. Noma kushoniwe kuyahlekwa.
Yes.
Even if when there's death, we still laugh.
You know what? I reckon one of the places you must have laughed quietly to yourself, or if you could have more publicly, was Oranje. I mean, that's interesting. You went there, and you were one of the first people to cover.
Yeah, Oranje was very interesting because I arrive in this white enclave. These people do not want to be part of the new South Africa. They want to stay in their own country. They want self-determination. That's what they told me. Mm-hmm. And when we were there, you see, when you work for the BBC, people tend to assume that the team who's coming to visit us comes from
England and
the United Kingdom or from Britain. Okay, so when you turn up, number one surprise is the unspoken language. So you see the eyes going clunk, You can see now they are surprised. And we stayed in a guest house in Oranje. There's very little else going around, by the way, there. And I was with two white colleagues. And they were offered rooms. And you know, people out in the countryside are very welcoming. They're very warm, and they look forward to hosting guests, sure, particularly from the cities. And the lady was very happy, and she just innocently, out of kindness, with no malice, offered me a room. And the rooms were not numbered, they were named.
Oh, okay.
So you had what room, the TF Malan room or something, in the guest house. Guess which room she offered me. Without thinking, I could tell she was not trying to be smart.
Which
or
one?
Anything. Guess. Henrik Verwoerd room. So, you can imagine how I felt. So I said, oh, it's a lovely room, but is there another one?
Something maybe a little less, yes.
And you know, sometimes when you pray, you don't see when God answers your prayers. Because I was thinking, oh Lord, I can't sleep here. No. This will be absolutely terrible.
Your ancestors and the ghost of H.F. Verwoerd will be battling over your bed.
I'm
all
telling
night.
You, the Nkosis, the Dlaminis were drumming up in the mountains. And you know what happened? She said, oh, the blue room is available, sir. I said, oh, thank you very much.
Perfect. You'll take it, yeah. It was probably a shittier room, but it was worth it, right? What an interesting place. I mean, you must have met some very strange people there, and you've met lots of strange people. Tell me about Darfur, because that's still, it's fallen off the news in some ways, but it's still a problem. It's still going on. There's still these huge swathes of land occupied by people living in tents with hardly any water, hardly any food, fearing for their lives every day and night.
So Darfur is very interesting. That's a very good question, because like you say, it's very interesting how you asked that question. It's not in the news anymore.
Mm.
Actually, it is. The whole al-Bashir case is about Darfur.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. So we're talking about al-Bashir, how South Africa was supposed to arrest him. For what? What did he do?
Mm.
He is charged with genocide in Darfur by the International Criminal Court. But we don't think about Darfur. We're thinking about the person, the personalities involved, President al-Bashir. So we are writing a lot about that in the BBC. We're trying to explain why he's been charged by the International Criminal Court and the whole thing that unfolded here in South Africa.
Well, even our own court said, I think the Supreme Court of Appeal said the other day that he indeed should have been arrested.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And I spent time there. There are key towns in Darfur. The biggest one is called El Janina. There's El Nyala and there's Al Shifa. Nyala and Al Shifa. And you know, Darfur is the size of France. That's how big that place is. So to travel there, you have to fly a long distance. In fact, one of the most interesting things I learned about Darfur is that El Janina is one of the furthest places from the sea in the world.
Really?
Stupid it's, fact. It's but it's one of those interesting things that you come away with from stories that actually you would never use. But it just it got stuck.
That's fascinating. It's also very dry there.
It's very, very dry. It's barren. You know what was fascinating? I'll tell you a short story. We were there and there was the African Union peacekeeping mission there. And part of those troops, some of them come from Ghana, Nigeria and so on, were South Africans. So a South African guy takes us around. We are walking, looking at what they are doing, he's telling us. And he was saying, oh, you know, I don't understand. This is a black South African SADF member, SANDF. And he showing us proudly how their presence has calmed the situation and how they are moving, you know, this group called the Janjaweed outside the areas where there are women and children, etc. And he said something fascinating, which I used to hear from conservative white South Africans under apartheid, that black men are lazy, they sit there, they do nothing, and they let all the women do the work. That's what I grew up with in the stereotypical sense of a description of a black man in South Africa by white men. Now, this guy is black. He's South African. And he's walking us around. And he says, here, guys, I don't understand this. Look at these guys. They sit under the tree all day. Yeah, he's pointing at the men there. Mm. They sit there and they let the women go and get the wood and they cook and they watch the kids. Wow. I don't know what they're doing there.
See what I mean?
Now, that was very funny.
But you see, long perspective of history. Like, only the experience of having seen that happen under apartheid conditions here in South Africa did you know that that was ironic.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't have appreciated it for anything. You would have said, oh, well, yeah, interesting observation.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was just fascinating to hear it from a black guy talking about other guys in Sudan. He was saying it without thinking, just showing us around. But for me, it resonated because I remembered how black people used to be described.
Well, you mentioned al-Bashir. It must have been fascinating to have been in Zaire during the time that Mobutu Sese Seko was president there. A lot of people don't remember, but going back much, much further, almost to the time that the Belgians left the Congo, this has been a very violent, very dangerous, very difficult part of this continent. And Mobutu Sese Seko was eventually the guy who managed to put together some semblance of a country. Of course, he became his own people's worst enemy.
Yeah.
Towards the end.
Yeah, Mobutu Sese Seko was very corrupt, and he was supported by the West. Ronald Reagan liked him, and they thought, you know, he's a good guy. And that's how, if you remember, the rumble in the jungle, how Muhammad Ali went to have that big fight there. But the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, as we know it now, is an amazing country. The people are fantastic. Full of energy. Yeah. They are absolutely fantastic. Kinshasa is so much alive. And sometimes when you're in Johannesburg and you see all these people coming in and they're poor and they end up in Hillbrow and other places, you just don't know where they come from. They come from absolutely hot cities. Okay, but they decided that they want to be here. And when I'm in Kinshasa, I feel at home. I feel the really? Love. I feel the vibe. It is just an amazing, amazing place. But when we were there during the war, I remember just at the end of Mobutu Sese Seko's time there, this is May 1997, the rebels are coming in. They marched all the way from the east in Goma through Kisangani across the jungle, and now they were 30 kilometers away from Kinshasa, and they were approaching a bridge called Kenge Bridge. And the headquarters in Kinshasa, which is their Mahlamba Ndlovu, if you like,
right,
is called Kamchachi. He's there. The country has collapsed. He's got nothing. And a general tells him, Monsieur, they're at Kenge Bridge. There's now nothing left. And the guy said, I've got the jet engines running. The car is running. Please leave.
It's time.
And the wife apparently stood up and said, well, if you won't leave, I am leaving.
Wow. What happened to what happened? Because I've forgotten what happened with Mobutu Sese Seko.
Yeah, he went into exile. I think he died. He had prostate cancer. In fact, when I went to Lubumbashi, and I also went to Kasai Oriental in Mbujimayi, that's the diamond center of the DRC. They had their own currency, which they called prostat, which was named after prostate cancer, which Mobutu
which
suffered from.
Mobutu.
Yeah, so he died in exile, and he was from a village in the Congo called Kabodelite, and he had built one of the biggest runways there. That's how powerful he was. Imagine with all our Nkandla scandals
isn't
here.
It's like when P.W. Botha built that big airport at George. I mean, that was essentially built
yes,
for him.
Yes, yes. No, sorry, I was going to make an even more ridiculous example. Theoretically, imagine if President Zuma, after all what has happened in Nkandla, and he lays a runway that can take the Concorde.
Well, that's kind of what... this is the kind of... It could only happen on this continent of ours and when people become too powerful for their own good, right?
Very, very true. And, you know, power and money, when you look around the world, you see how sometimes even very innocent people get corrupted. I mean, you see in South Africa, people who went to prison, people who struggled in exile for the democracy, and how when money and power comes, they suddenly even they themselves forget what they went through to fight for the democracy. So it's pretty sad.
And it's not just an African thing. This happens all over the world. You went to Iraq and you saw the weapons inspectors doing their inspections of Iraq in Baghdad, 1998.
Yeah, that's before Bill Clinton, who was threatening to bomb in 1998, bomb Saddam Hussein. And you know what they had then, if you remember, there was a no-fly zone. So you could not fly into Baghdad. So you needed to fly to Amman in Jordan and drive,
which is a long
15
way.
Hours across mm-hmm. the desert. You know, it was just an amazing experience. And you know, Iraq is in the Bible as we know it, in the First Testament.
Mesopotamia.
And you know, 45 minutes south of Baghdad is what city? The first
Babylon.
City on earth. Babylon.
Right.
So when you are there, you get the sense of history. So the here and now, like we were saying earlier about Twitter, you can see it, but at the same time, you start to think back. So Tariq Aziz, who was
between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
Yes, that's where most people believe that the Garden of Eden is.
Now, did you ever go to Babylon? See the ruins of the old city?
Oh, yes. Drove past it because I used to drive, you know. So if we didn't do the Amman route, we'd go via Kuwait.
Right.
So what you do is when you leave now, you can drive from Baghdad south. You can go via Nasiriyah and go past Babylon very quickly. It's just outside Baghdad. And then go all the way down to Basra, either go via Umkasa or Al-Qut, and then you end up in Kuwait. And then suddenly, voila, you're there.
Wow. What does it look like, Babylon? Is there anything left there?
Well, it's ruins. It's very old. For the ordinary person, I think if you're an archaeologist, it's just absolutely mind-blowing, you know. But and once you've read the Bible and you know the power of the place, then you get a sense of history when you're there.
Well, that
but
was if the place you that are, was where Alexander the Great died.
Yeah.
It was where this was the center of the Persian Empire of. You know?
Very much so. You
Babylon.
Know, I was going to tell you about
where the Jews were taken after the sack of Jerusalem.
I'll tell you what Tariq Aziz said to us when we asked him, the Americans are about to bomb. What are you going to do? And he had a very thick accent. You remember Tariq Aziz? Thick glasses, cigar smoking, very smart guy. And he said, you know, the Americans are very powerful. They've got many big weapons. They can come and bomb our cities, bomb the bridges, the roads, the buildings. But they cannot break the spirit of the people of Iraq. We survived 5 millenniums. They're only 200 years old.
Wow. That's quite something.
Now, you walk out of that interview, tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, you're bound to have a much better idea of what's really going on, because we only ever hear one side of this most of the time. Mm. Most people, you know, if you watch ANN 7, then you think that everybody's after President Zuma. You know, if you watch just CNN, you're going to think that the Americans are always right.
Very true.
And that everybody else is out to get them.
You know, I'll tell you a short story, okay? I took my kids on holiday to see tigers in India, and we went to a very, very interesting historical park called Ranthambore. And in Ranthambore, we're driving around with a ranger looking for tigers, and all we're seeing is buck, so we're getting a little bit frustrated. Behaving like international tourists when they don't see the big five, and you keep seeing impalas. So... In my impatience, there was a big fort, an old fort, big wall, about 3 stories high, but stones, built on stones, you know, very imposing in the middle of this park. And I said, what is this? Tell us about this then. And the guy said, sir, this is the fort. Sir, it was, we don't know how old it is, but the first, what we know, sir, is that the first recorded time is the 6th century.
Wow.
Okay. Now, at that point, you always think, you know, the Indians are so chaotic. And before you know it, you stop dead on your tracks and you are retracting every thought you had about. Then you realize these guys have been around for much longer. I mean, what can we point out to that was built like that size of a structure in the 6th century?
No, it's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal.
Now, that stuff, when you walk away... You stop when you're seeing Indians and you see the traffic, you know how the stereotypes.
Mm.
You just think you guys don't know nothing.
These people,
you haven't seen
these people
nothing
the,
yet.
The
go there and see what these people have done and where they come from.
Yeah, an ancient civilization. It's quite incredible. But if we do come back to our history, because our history is nothing to be embarrassed about, particularly our recent history. I mean, you watched the demise of the apartheid regime. You saw the rise of the ANC and Nelson Mandela. I mean, to have eyewitnessed some of that and to have the access that you would have as a journalist was very special. That's unlike anything else in most people's experiences.
Yeah, I mean, there are many anecdotes about the end of apartheid. The one that stays in my mind when I think about it is that on the 27th of April, 1994, it's the biggest day we've been waiting for. We've been working so hard towards that day. And what happened is that we had chosen a voting station in Orlando West. That's where we were going to base ourselves. We had our satellite trucks there. We put all our might there because we thought we could talk to the people, etc. And we are standing outside Orlando West Holy Cross Church, which happens to be my old stamping ground. And an old man walks past, and we're asking people at random, how was it to vote for the first time? What did you think? Blah, 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 blah. We're trying to get as much information as possible. And this guy stops. And he says, my name is Mr. Captain. He was very tall, very regal, like Mandela.
Hmm.
And he said, I've been a teacher all my life. I'm 75 now, I'm retired. And I voted for the very first time in the country of my birth. Today, I feel like a human being. And he walked. And we were like,
that's incredible.
Yeah, simple conversation, very quick, man. People are walking past, it's all, you know, happening, you know. But we were like stuck in space. I just felt silence.
Mm.
I was completely blown away by that. But again, I get easily blown away.
No, I don't think so. I think the things that you talk about as blowing you away are things that have blown the world away. They're not things that are just, you know, personal experiences.
But there are other funny moments, end of apartheid. So you know that in South Africa is the only country in the world that has a separate race called the coloureds.
Yeah.
And we were covering a protest in Westbury, not far from the SABC, and the coloured community there was protesting against the SABC. They felt that as the airwaves were being opened up, remember SABC was dominated by Africans in English, and the airwaves were opening up to black audiences on television. And what happened is that suddenly the colored community thought, hey, why is there no colored channel coming up, you know? Because everybody seems to have their own, right?
Right.
So we're covering this protest, and we meet this guy outside the SABC. They're chanting there with placards, very small group. And we say, so why are you protesting? He says, no, my brother, man, I buy a color TV, and all I see is black and white.
Now listen, there's actually a good reason that you're here too. We're celebrating the BBC News' 25th anniversary, is that right?
Very much so. The channel is on DSTV, channel 400. It's called BBC World News, and it is the international facing channel for the British Broadcasting Corporation. There are many other channels in the UK online, but this one is the main international facing channel, and that's what, when people talk about BBC around the world, that's what they talk about, that's what they watch. And today, this month, BBC World News is celebrating 25 years of existence.
And you're celebrating having been with the BBC for more than 20 years. That's quite incredible these days.
Yeah, 26 years. It feels very embarrassing when you listen to young people who've been job hopping and telling you how many jobs they've done in their five-year careers. And I feel like an old geezer who has stayed in one place without any movement whatsoever. But of course, you know, I've had many jobs. It's a big operation, the BBC. So I've had many jobs within the BBC. So it is as good as changing jobs.
And you like working with them.
Well, In fairness, Gareth, I wouldn't have been there for this long if I didn't.
Sure.
There are frustrations. It's not perfect, like anywhere else, and there are things you don't like, and there are things that you like. But overall, get the most trusted brand, news brand in the world. And if there is another one, you can tell me about it. They are the oldest broadcasters in the world. They're broadcasting 1922 to the Pacific Broadcasting Corporation. They get it right most of the time than most other news organizations. So they are phenomenally brilliant. And everybody, even during a war, both sides trust the BBC. And that's why we can go anywhere. And nowadays, to find someone who's fair, who can listen to you in an impartial way, is very rare. Because even if you get journalists arriving and saying, can I get a comment, you can now already think of the site that they own and they're coming with an agenda. We tend to come in genuinely, genuinely, completely open-minded. And we just say, tell us what's going on, who shot who, why are you shooting this, that they took up on that, and why were you taking the element when they didn't tell you that they took it first in 100 years ago. That's how we get the information.
So you're not a fan of Fox News, Derek?
I'm a very big fan of the British Broadcasting Corporation, and we're doing a lot of work online. So, for example, bbc.com/Africa is our page. So if you ever wanted to get reliable, accurate information, you need to go there to just to be sure what's going on. Remember, nowadays on Twitter, if you recall, not so long ago, Mr. Mandela died so many times on Twitter when he was still actually alive. And I saw it a lot in South Asia where Osama bin Laden was caught and had died before it actually happened. So you can't rely on social media. You need someone who's balanced,
credible,
who is credible, who is fair, who can do the research. In the BBC, we use, and I know most international news organizations do the same, we use a two sources strategy. In other words, the rule is that you don't go to air if you don't have a second source to corroborate the first thing you hear. So if someone says to me, breaking news, this is what has happened, I'm like, okay, good, I trust you and I think you're right, but I must find out from somebody else if this is true.
It seems as though these days the main goal is to be the first person to break the story.
Even if you're not accurate.
Even if you're not 100% sure of the facts, it seems as though
that's important. Other people, if you follow strategies of news organizations, they decide it's better to be first than to be right. We want to be right and to be first. So it's a difficult balance to strike. Most people break news on the bottom part of the screen. They use a graphic, breaking news, and 2 hours later that graphic disappears and nobody says anything about it because the whole thing was a rumor and they're embarrassed to tell you and they don't tell you. And nobody complains because we're used to that now. But in the BBC, if we said breaking news, plane crash, and then we say, oops, sorry, there was no plane crash, the amount of complaints we get, because people tend to say, my normal channel is channel so-and-so, I watch this channel, blah, blah, blah. But when we know it's all going down, like you have a massive well story, like the Twin Towers coming down, 9/11, or you have Mandela coming out of prison, everybody leaves their traditional stations and they go to the BBC.
Yeah. Look, I need to know how it feels to interview people as varied as you have. You've spoken to world leaders. And a lot of these people must have been a lot more interesting than you thought, and some of them must have been a lot more boring than you thought they would be. Who stands out for you? Because you've got such a list of people that you've spoken to.
Oh, my goodness. It's very hard because I have my personal favorites, and I've got people who are very sharp in politics and dull in private life. And
tell me about your personal favorites.
Okay. So, for example, I'll tell you a short story. I met Bill Clinton in a private residence. A friend of mine invites me to dinner, says, I've got a very special friend who I'd like you to meet. Please come to my house.
Is this here in South Africa?
Yeah,
in
Johannesburg. Okay. Johannesburg, an American friend. So I go to the house for dinner and I walk in there. There are other guests and the main guest is Bill Clinton. So it's a private residence, so we have a chat. So you go beyond there, can I have a selfie, please, quickly? And then you have a proper conversation. And we have conversations about everything. And fast forward.
Is this post him being president?
Yes, just after it finished. And then fast forward now to 2012. I'm in Kunu covering Nelson Mandela's birthday. And it's cold, it's July, and we are interviewing people. All sorts of charities are there, 67 minutes, and you know how it goes there. All sorts of PR people are doing their work. And Clinton is there with his daughter Chelsea. So I say to my cameraman, you know, we must ask Clinton. It would be nice to have a clip of Clinton in this piece, right? And my friend says, hey, these Americans, you know, they won't allow you. Look at the security there. I'm like, yeah, you know, I met the guy, but I'm not sure if you'll remember me. I'll shout. Okay. So Clinton finishes the cutting the ribbon and all of that. He's walking towards the car. So we think, okay. So there's a scrum around him. You know, all cameras are there. So I said to Glenn, let's move back. Just leave them. Because once he says something to them, you know us, journalists, we're like kids. You give us a little sweetie, we walk away. Okay, we stop crying.
Leave him alone.
Yeah.
Right.
So we thought, just leave him. You know, let them have a sound bite and then he'll keep walking. So we went closer to the car. And then suddenly, Clinton is coming towards us. And I say, Mr. President, I don't know if you remember me. He says, Melton.
Wow.
My knees were shaking. You know, that's what makes the guy. And I said to him, Mr. President, I thought you'd never remember. You met so many people. He says, we had one of the most interesting conversations. How could I forget? And we even danced. And we smoked cigars and all that.
Wow.
So I was completely blown away by just the sharpness of the mind. And he gave us, of course, the most desired sound bites and described Mr. Mandela as one of the greatest lives lived in modern times.
Unbelievable. Are there people who've disappointed you? You wanted to meet them and you sat and then they were either just very rehearsed, very scripted, very planned, very academic?
Yeah, I think most people, and I sympathize a lot with them, because when we come with cameras and the lights and the cables and all the production
teams,
very intimidating, and people over prepare. So we were in Angola, in Luanda, and we are doing a story about the Angolan diamonds, and we're meeting a very senior executive of a mining conglomerate. And he's very posh, he's a British guy, and he's rehearsed, he's crammed everything. And we're supposed to spend half an hour in his office, and 3 hours later, we're calming him down, giving him ice cubes, because we're so desperate for the clip. And he just can't get a straight sentence out. Very bright guy. And he's got the pose, the suit, the cufflinks, the hair, but he can't give us a sound bite. And we were doing a longer piece, so you need something much more thoughtful instead of a 10-second sound bite.
Right.
And it was the most amazing experience. Amazing. And then we said to him, okay, look, it's quite clear you have rehearsed some lines which you can't finish. So don't worry. We are with you. We are on the same side. Can we help you? Where are the lines? You know, get us the piece of paper. And then he opens the drawer and he puts them there. He's completely, completely embarrassed, but he's giving in. He wants to be helped because he still wants to be on TV. So the ego is still looking for that TV screenshot. So he gets out the notes he's been reading, and we can see the lines he's battling with. And we say, look, read this thing. Forget what you crammed. Understand it. Tell us what you think about what you read.
Okay,
now we are having a conversation. So we are filming without looking at him. So we press the camera and we look away so that he relaxes, you know, so that he doesn't feel the pressure. And that was an incredible experience because, you know, we all laughed about it and we gossiped a little bit about it. But, you know, when you're alone, you start to think, my goodness, imagine the BBC comes to your office all the lights and they're asking you all these difficult questions and you've prepared. And suddenly it just doesn't want to come out. What do you do? So I felt sorry for the guy after having laughed at him so hard that my tummy ached.
Are there people who've really impressed you? Who the world has said horrible things? You mentioned Tariq Aziz earlier, but there are people who perhaps the world has demonized subsequently, who were really, really impressive people, and who you think might have been misrepresented by the media as a whole.
Well, that's very hard. The most people who leave indelible marks in my mind are ordinary people, like Mr. Captain. Okay, this guy is no name, walking out of voting station, and he blows me away. And I can still talk about him 24 years later. When was it? So you are left with that impression. Look at that gentleman. I don't even know his name. The guy who told me that he buys a color TV, all he sees is black and white. Those people are the people I think about, and those are the people I talk about when I get home. So I don't talk about the guy who gives the nice statement, you know. But there was a very interesting guy I met once called Harry Gwala, the Lion of the Midlands. He was an ANC and SACP leader. He was paralyzed. He had his hands were sort of hanging. He could not, you know, move them like we do now, up and down. Mm-hmm. They were just sort of hanging on the side. Very, very interesting guy. Very bright. So at the time, there was a lot of violence in the Midlands. ANC versus Nkata. Whichever title you want to put on the violence, you can. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was ANC against Nkata. And Harry Gwala was tired of the approach from the Secretary General of the ANC at the time, Cyril Ramaphosa, who adopted a very reconciliatory, trying to keep everything down. They want to end this whole apartheid thing without bloodshed. And there's a bit of bloodshed, serious, etc. But they wanted to follow the rule of law. So what would happen is that after a massacre in a village in KwaZulu-Natal, the ANC would issue a statement, and most of the time would be Cyril Ramaphosa, the Secretary General of the time, and he would say something like, "We condemn the killing of our innocent people. We are calling for those who committed this heinous crime to be brought to book mm-hmm. as soon as possible. We will leave no stone unturned until everyone faces justice."
That sounds like a prepared statement.
Okay,
I've ever heard
so
one.
That
yeah.
was
right.
normally what we used to cover.
Right.
And then there would be Harry Gwala. So we're sitting there, and he would say, "No, we will kill them when they come to kill us. We won't meet them with Bibles singing hosannas." I just remember thinking, wow, this guy is amazing. And this is the guy who taught President Zuma how to read and write, amongst others, in prison.
Well, that tells us a lot. That tells us a huge amount. Do you look at modern politics, and I mean, we're running out of time here. I've got to clear the way for Loyiso. But when you look at politics at the moment, and again, with that perspective that you have and the fact that you can see how far we've come, do you think we get hysterical about stupid things sometimes?
Yeah, we're in the information age. So what happens is that we have access to too much information. So I remember Donald Trump, Donald Rumsfeld, who used to be the American Defense Secretary. I would never like to quote Donald Trump personally, but in this particular instance, he is quotable. What he said was that people were asking, "You said this war would end very quickly, blah, 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 and now it seems to be dragging." He says, "No, you guys, you're watching 24-hour news channels. We used to watch the Second World War in the cinema before the main feature. And the tape, the film that would come, would have come 2 weeks from the event." Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we are watching wars live. Live, we're watching a war. And it's very hard to distance yourself. And this takes us back to where we began. It's very, very important to take a step back and look at things from a global perspective. Because if you follow a block by block, street by street, sort of Mogadishu style fighting, you would think that the whole world is actually on fire. And when you step back, you look at Africa, for example, we have now more democracies, fewer dictators than we had in the past. Mm. So things are actually changing for the better. But my goodness. And also, as communities rise in their levels of standard of living, they get more worried. So the people who complain the most are the people who have the most.
Absolutely. No, it's a very good point. I mean, there's so much that we've learned from you today. Thank you, Milton. Please keep on doing the good work that you're doing. It's such an incredible thing to be able to hear the stories of someone who's lived through so much of this firsthand and who's reported it to all of us over the years. Please keep doing the amazing work.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And happy 25th anniversary to BBC World News.
Thank you very much. I'll pass on the news if they're not listening already.
Thank you so much. There we go. Milton Nkosi from the BBC Africa. What an incredible guest and what a lovely discussion. CliffCentral.com.